Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and permanently archived when finished at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do Part 3, Chapter 16, Hiala, Florida, 1972, from E. Michael Jones's Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control, out of South Bend, Indiana, in 2000 by St. Augustine's Press. E. Michael Jones can be found at culturewars.com. Let's dig in. This is a very brief chapter, only about 5 pages, so. Part 3, Chapter 16, Hiala, Florida, 1972. And I gotta say, I don't know anything about Hiala, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, Florida. It's not, I think there's a dog track there or something. That's about the only thing I've heard in connection to that city. In the early afternoon of October 28, 1972, when the Reich Revival, Wilhelm Reich, was in full bloom, the police dispatcher in Hiala, H-I-A-L-E-A-H, Florida, got a call from a man named Harry who claimed that his wife had become violent and needed to be subdued. When the police officer arrived on the scene, he found the once famous pinup model Betty Page in the front of the house, beating her husband, Harry, with her fists and bellowing curses at him. After Officer Fitzpatrick led Betty away to the back of the police car, he returned to the house to get a statement from Harry. When he returned to the car, he found Betty in the back seat with her dress pulled up and her pants pulled down, masturbating with a hanger the officer had left in the car. His verdict was that the suspect was out of her mind, completely berserk. Betty was found unfit to stand trial and committed to a mental institution. 7 years later, she was out on the streets again, this time living in California, when her neighbor saw her emerge from the bushes wielding an 8-inch-long serrated bread knife, which Betty began to plunge repeatedly into the woman's body. When the woman's husband came to her aid, Betty began stabbing him as well. Betty had spent her adult life arousing the passions of others. Now, after a life of promiscuous relations with various men, she discovered that those same passions had taken on a life of their own and were now telling her what to do. Quote, "Desire doubled is love," the 5th-century sophist Prodicus had written. "And love doubled is madness." Never heard of Prodicus. Prodicus. In the expensive school of experience, the moderns were rediscovering what the ancients had known all along. Excessive passion, according to Bruce S. Thornton's reading of that tradition, is fundamentally a form of insanity, a destruction of the rational mind's control over the body, a suspension of reason's power that allows the soul to be overwhelmed by the chaos of the natural appetites and emotions. Betty led a dissolute life beginning with her 18th year. While in high school, she was one of the top students in her class and planned at the time to become a teacher. By the mid-50s, when she was approaching 40, she had descended into psychosis. She had become incapable of finishing any of the many Bible courses she was enrolled in and was a threat to the life and well-being of those around her. Foster gives all of the usual Freudian explanations, including the most plausible, the one, by the way, which Freud rejected as the seduction theory, namely that she had been molested by her father as a child. No one should minimize the trauma associated with events like that, but by the same token, the trauma in this instance took on psychic importance the further away in time it receded, which is a good indication that it functioned as a screen memory for something more closely associated to the present, namely her sexual behavior as an adult. If the particulars of modesty are culturally relative, the consequences of lust are not. The first consequence of promiscuity, according to the order of being, is the dissolution of the self. The self is constituted by its relationships. The trauma of a father transgressing those boundaries might have been healed by an understanding husband in a permanent monogamous relationship, but that was not Betty's fate. The easy money from the photo sessions must have made easy relationships seem equally inconsequential, but at a certain point, psychic reality caught up with Betty, and when it did, the passions of the self, aroused at will, began to assert their hegemony over a self that was no longer in a position to control them. In 1957, Betty simply dropped out of the New York pinup scene and moved to Florida, where she became involved with a man 13 years her junior. They eventually got married, but as with her other marriages, this one didn't last either. And with each failed relationship, we can see that the glue that held her personality together was becoming more elastic and less retentive. It was at this point in her life that Betty got religion, as many women do. If she had been living in Corinth during the time of St. Paul, or the time St. Paul was writing to the formerly dissolute citizens of that city, she would have been told to keep her head covered and her mouth shut during religious services. Betty never had any children. By the time she was approaching 40, she must have realized that she never would have any and started to devote her spare time to raising plants by way of compensation. She meticulously watered and cared for the plants, Foster tells us, as if they were the children she never had. The religion Betty eventually got had little to do with the morality traditionally associated with Christianity. Betty was still good-looking enough to pick up a man at a dance, which is what she did in Miami. When she met a divorced telephone lineman by the name of Harry Lear, she was still interested in marriage, which is what happened once again, but she was incapable of remaining married because her craziness kept intruding into the relationship until it finally destroyed it. In spite of studying theology at a number of Bible institutes, Betty came to believe that there were seven gods, and she knew this because she would have extended conversations with them while locked in the bathroom. It was after an especially long conference in the home of an aging widow in California that Betty rushed out of the bathroom with a serrated bread knife in her hand and proceeded to stab her housemate repeatedly, almost killing her in the process. Betty was 49 years old at the time, and the policeman concluded that she was mentally ill, a judgment with which the court which committed her to a mental institution concurred. But what is mental illness? Psychiatrists of the Thomas Szasz, S-Z-A-S-Z, that's an important name, school compare the term mental illness to saying that God has an appendicitis. The mind cannot be ill because it is not a physical entity. In a Freudian age, the term has come to mean exculpation and the triumph of the therapeutic, to use Philip Reif's term. But what does mental illness mean? In addition to the meaning of the loss of behavior in conformity to the canons of what society calls civil, the state of mind means the inability of the self to integrate experiences and desires in a coherent pattern of behavior. If a healthy person is one whose sense of self has hegemony over his desires, a mentally ill person is someone where the opposite is the case. They can't control their desires. Their desires control them. By the time Betty was 49 years old, her desires, whether concupiscible or irascible, that is, lust or anger, had hegemony over herself. Betty simply did what the voices, i.e. her out-of-control passions, told her to do. Rather than admit that promiscuity leads to this state unerringly, the culture which promotes sexual license chose instead to say that the monster they had created to satisfy their illicit desires was crazy, and leave it at that. So, is that really true, though, that most people who are very promiscuous end up crazy like that? I think Jones would have a very hard time proving that, but he's asserting that it happens unerringly. Betty was found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to the mental hospital. She was described as mentally ill when a better diagnosis might have been that herself had simply collapsed under the assault of her desires, to the point where the desires and not the self had taken charge of her behavior. I don't find that particularly persuasive myself. The culture which had turned her into an icon would rather not admit this fact, because by admitting that it would be admitting culpability in her demise. Instead, we find as the only explanation a radical discontinuity to the point of incoherence. She slept with all these guys. She went nuts, all smoothed over by the psychic numbing which 50 years of pornography created in those who consumed it. Betty, we are told, by the way, liked horror movies, but her biographer understands a connection between sex and horror every bit as little as Betty herself, a lady who was doomed to live the trajectory she never learned to understand. The consequences of extrapolating this sort of behavior to the culture at large have occurred to others as well. Philip Cushman, writing in the May 1990 issue of American Psychologist, describes the historical trajectory that usually gets denominated, quote, liberation, unquote, by the sexual Whigs, that's liberals, or progressives, as the emergence of the empty self. Unlike the Victorian self, which is defined by relationships made possible by adherence to the moral law, block quote, the current self is constructed as empty, and as a result, the state controls its population not by restricting the impulses of its citizens, as in the Victorian times, but by creating and manipulating their wish to be soothed, organized, and made cohesive by momentarily filling them up. The products of the social sciences, and of psychology in particular, have often worked to the advantage of the state by helping to construct selves that are the means of control. Cushman goes on to say that the configuration of the self, which has emerged since the end of World War II, is, quote, empty in part because of the loss of family, community, and tradition. It is a self that seeks the experience of being continually filled up by consuming goods, calories, experiences, politicians, romantic partners, and empathetic therapists in an attempt to combat the growing alienation and fragmentation of its era. The cultural paradigm of numb decadence, which Richard Weaver feared in Ideas Have Consequences, has, in other words, become the cultural norm. The cultural paradigm of numbed decadence, Richard Weaver warned about in Ideas Have Consequences, has become the cultural norm. Numbed decadence. The sexual engineers have created a world in which sexual excess led to madness with increasing regularity. But because the instruments of culture approved of this transformation by calling it liberation, that is, calling it the opposite of what it is, which is gaslighting, trying to get you to believe something that's the opposite of the truth, not to not trust the data and not trust your own experience and not trust your own eyes and get you to believe that the longer pencil is actually the shorter one, as in that famous experiment you may have seen or heard about if you ever took psychology. The sexual engineers have created a world in which sexual excess led to madness with increasing regularity, but because the instruments of culture approved of this transformation, calling it liberation, that is the media, etc., and the government, it was only rarely described in any accurate fashion. The numbness which resulted from the widespread dissemination of transgressive imagery of the sort that started with the photos of Betty Page was turning people into sexual monsters. Shortly before Betty Page was apprehended by the Hiala police, a young woman by the name of Linda Borman, B-O-R-E-M-A-N, was lying in a chaise lounge outside her parents' house, not far away in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, recuperating from a car accident, when a high school friend from New Jersey drove up from Miami and introduced her to a man by the name of Chuck Traynor. T-R-A-Y-N-O-R. Traynor was 6 years older than Borman, and she found him slightly attractive. More than slightly attractive was his car, a burgundy Jaguar XKE, not the kind of car the people she usually dated usually drove. Traynor was unusual in other ways, although Borman did not know that at the time. Borman had been raised in Yonkers by her policeman father and a mother who had sent her to Catholic schools, where she aspired first to be a nun, and then to get married and raise a family. In Traynor, Borman saw a way of escaping from under parental domination. It was a bit like jumping from the frying pan into the fire. Nothing happened in the first few dates. Then the seduction began in earnest. Traynor persuaded Borman to have sex, and each time she agreed to his demands, the ante got raised, and each time the sexual demands became more perverse and bizarre, the bondage increased. Traynor's sexual demands were a technique for extinguishing the self that had moral objections. Once that was out of the way, the sexual partner was turned into a sexual object, and the sexual object was turned into a sexual slave. As part of his regimen of control, Traynor would regularly hypnotize Borman and then get her to do things she would not otherwise have done under post-hypnotic suggestion. Claiming that it would help her stop smoking, Traynor used hypnosis to eliminate Borman's gag reflex, and then taught her the fellatio technique that would make her famous as Linda Lovelace in Deep Throat, the top-grossing porno film of all time. So again, we're talking about when there was New York had a CD section and there were porn theaters, and even before the VCR, let alone before the internet. So we went from kind of underground printed materials to more overt open stuff in the early 70s, and then to CD sections of town with adult theaters are now allowed, and porno movies, and Deep Throat's probably the biggest of them, and then eventually onto the VCR and the internet. But so that's the trajectory of the techniques of delivering pornography. Now, that, however, was in the future, the Deep Throat. In between naivete and porno stardom, Trainor turned Borman into a prostitute and used all of the instruments of control in her that pimps know to keep women in line. The result was that Borman became, in her own words, a robot. In many ways, the fulfillment of the prophecy of Marquis de Sade that, quote, woman is a machine for voluptuousness, a sex machine. After a session which Trainor arranged with five men in a motel room in Florida, Borman would claim, I felt as though myself had been taken away from me. I was not a person anymore. I was a robot, a vegetable, a wind-up toy, a fucking and sucking doll. I had become someone else's thing. The use of sex as a form of domination would only deepen the longer she remained with Trainor, who eventually took her to New York, where the lofts of New York City that Betty Page had known had taken a decided turn in the direction of degradation. It was while in New York City that Trainor arranged to the filming of Borman having sex with a dog. The results were predictable. With each new degradation, Borman slipped more completely under Trainor's control. That was, in effect, the main purpose of the degradation, to keep her docile and feeling, as she later put it, totally defeated. After the episode with the dog, Borman was taken to a party where her fellatio technique came to the attention of a porno filmmaker by the name of Jerry Damiano, who came up with the idea of doing a big-budget 35mm film based on Borman's specialty. 6 months later, Borman, now under the name of Linda Lovelace, awoke to find that the world considered her not a prisoner in the white slavery business, but a star. By 1972, pornography had become respectable. It had become, in the words of the New York Times, chic. So chic, in fact, that the New York Times news staff spent their lunch hour viewing the film. Joining the reporters from the Times and enjoying viewing Borman being sexually assaulted were, quote, Johnny Carson, Mike Nichols, Sandy Dennis, Ben Gazzara, and Jack Nicholson, as well as some French UN diplomats who insisted on paying with traveler's checks. All of these folks felt, according to the Times, that, quote, there is no harm or shame in indulging their curiosity, and perhaps even their frankly prurient interest, by going to see Deep Throat. The courts evidently disagreed, for on December 18, 1972, the film house which showed Deep Throat went on trial, bringing forth all of the usual suspects, in this instance Kinsey protege John Money of Johns Hopkins, willing to testify to the film's redeeming social value. Remember, that was the judicial criterion from earlier. The judge, however, remained unimpressed, announcing that, quote, this is one throat that deserves to be cut. When he handed down the guilty verdict, the judge was style. I deliver a judgment, but I couch it in fine style. When he handed down the guilty verdict on March 7, 1973, levying a $2 million fine, pondering the significance of it all, William Pechter, writing in Commentary, P-E-C-H-T-E-R, could only opine that it indicated that, quote, we want pornography. We want it, but we don't want to admit to wanting it, and so we want it cloaked in art or some other socially respectable disguise. And that ends that brief chapter talking about Betty Page and her dissolution and Linda Lovelace, or Borman as her actual real name was. So thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you real soon, and we'll move on to chapter part 3, chapter 17.